Sponsorship of this KQED podcast is provided by San Jose State University Doctoral Program in Educational Leadership, a new professional degree program offered for leaders in education. Accepting applications at sjsu.edu/edd.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next up on Forum this morning, journalist and author Barbara Ehrenreich was trained as a scientist and is a longtime atheist. But in recent years, she's been grappling to understand a mystical experience she had as a teenager. The author of the bestseller Nickel and Dime, she'll join us to talk about her new book, Living with a Wild God, A Nonbeliever's Search for the Truth About Everything. And that's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Journalist and author Barbara Ehrenreich joins us in studio for this second Forum Hour this morning. The author of 14 books, including the best-selling Nickel and Dimed and Bait and Switch, she has done a kind of switch of her own by publishing a book, a memoir, which focuses on an inexplicable and ineffable, call it mystical experience, which occurred back in her youth, and which she, a lifetime atheist and non-believer, a trained scientist and a rationalist, long kept under wraps. Her book is called Living with a Wild God, A Nonbeliever's Search for the Truth About Everything, and she joins us in studio for the second hour. Welcome, Barbara Ehrenreich.
Good to be with you, Michael.
Good to have you back here on Forum, and maybe we ought to begin by talking about what this experience was. It started at 13, it went into flames at 17, and was in Lone Pine right here in the state of California. The analogy keeps coming to mind here is the burning bush, but maybe the burning bush with everything burning and without God.
There was no hint of a God in this experience. The burning bush just occurred to me many years later. The image of flame often occurs in accounts of mystical experiences. I didn't know until a couple decades ago that so many people had experiences that appear to be similar. Now, I'm not saying, you know, you can really easily compare things like this.
Some of them are religious and do involve God, of course, right?
Some of them are put in religious terms. Some of them are completely not. It's atheists, it's religious people, it's famous people and, you know, very ordinary people. So we don't have the demographics on this. We don't have a good database. But it took me a long time to figure out that this was not something that only happened to me.
Well, it happened to you in your own way. And translating it and going back to it all these years later and trying to make sense of it, you had to go back to a young girl who really intellectually ambitious beyond belief, thought that she could find the answers to the cosmos or the universe. That's presumably not who you are now. And so you had to kind of make some kind of connection with your younger self, didn't you?
Oh, I'm very much related to her, old as I am. No, that insane, perhaps hubristic ambition to understand everything has not gone away.
You still think you can do it?
I'm running out of time, but yeah, I got to get all the data I can.
I got a quote from you along those lines. If you're not prepared to die when you're almost 60, then I would say you've been falling down on your philosophical responsibilities as a grown-up human being.
That's right. I mean, it amazes me when I meet people and they say, I turned 60, guess what, I'm going to die. Yeah, we've known that for a long time.
But death was not on your mind when you were a teenager. It's usually not on most minds as teenagers.
No, it was. It was what? When I was when this questioning began, it was because I had the age of about 12, finally figured out that people die. And so what was all this about? You know, you spend a little time, you know, you were born and we do all this stuff only to get snuffed out. So, yes, it was very much on my mind.
Existential awakening comes with menstruation, doesn't it?
Sort of, in my case, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't put any cause and effect on that, though.
Well, what about cause and effect of your... You go into this book in real detail about your family life, and it's not a happy family life. In fact, it's... as much as you adored your father and a brilliant man he comes off being characterized as, he had problems with alcohol. Your mother had all kinds of problems with you.
Yes, it was a difficult family. I won't use the other D word. They are dysfunctional, but... Because I think my parents married too young when they were teenagers, and a lot of problems, one of which was very rapid class mobility. I can't call that a problem, right? It's good,
yeah,
right?
To it's move the American upward. Way, yeah.
Yeah. My father started as a miner, copper miner in Butte, Montana, and got a scholarship and eventually... became a white-collar executive type, not even in science or metallurgy. And that's good. Our houses got better, you know, more than one bathroom eventually. And at the same time, though, I think it was deeply disorienting. And that was, I would say, one factor in my father's drinking and my mother's.
You were also, I suppose, what we could characterize as hardcore atheist, even your grandmother throwing a crucifix. There's anecdotes like that. And so this experience becomes even more baffling in some ways because it could easily be labeled a religious experience. It's right out of William James' religious experience type of mystical.
Although William James' chapter on mystical experiences includes plenty of non-believers.
Yeah, I didn't mean to suggest
interpret
otherwise.
This
yeah.
as an encounter with a deity of any kind.
You were always certain that there was no deity. I mean, and always certain in
never
your
never entered
atheism.
My mind. And see, this is so interesting. I mean, theism rules our culture and our ways of thinking so much that it's almost impossible to think outside of that. I mean, you keep wanting to bring in God, and you're not the only interviewer. Who has brought in God.
No, I'm not necessarily bringing in God. I know you're a stone-cold atheist, and
okay.
I accept that. There's no reason that I
all
have.
Right,
I'm just saying that many of these experiences particularly have a religious label or have a kind
but
of
But we
God.
Don't even know – we don't know the numbers here. Like on – you have people like Virginia Woolf who had, quote, mystical experiences. And she was a rationalist, a total non-believer. I would say this is the test of whether you are a real non-believer. If you have one of these experiences and you fall down on your knees and you say, oh, that must be God, you fail a test. If you are a true atheist, you say, what was that? I better find out.
Well, and you certainly attempt to find out, although this remains in some ways inexplicable. I'm just wondering what it was like for you, who's been a chronicler and a journalist and in many ways a writer about social problems for a long time now, to write about all this inward stuff, right, personally, a whole different track for you.
Well, I felt a little guilty. I felt it was self-indulgent in some way and vain to write something so centered on myself. It took me a long time to get around to this, Michael, and there's always other stuff that has to be done that's very, very urgent. So this would go to the bottom of the pile again and again. But ultimately, I conceived it as kind of a responsibility. First,
well, we're asking for your papers, too, right?
That's a library wanting my papers.
Yeah.
For, I don't know what they do with papers.
No, but I mean, you came back to this journal that you had written as a young
girl. I found the journal again. Yeah. There's one thing is my responsibility to my own children. You know, I wanted to share in some way what had, something about my background and my intellectual growing up. But it was also, there was a responsibility to the girl who wrote that journal, starting at age 14. I wrote that journal then only for my future self. And I thought the future of the future self as being a few months off. What I didn't realize it would be decades before I came back to this journal. And there is a place in the journal from when I was 16 years old where I say to my older self, my future self, please read this with compassion because I thought my writing was so terrible. And probably, and also it said, what have you done What have you figured out by now? Which is a big challenge to come hurling out across the decades at you.
You're almost taunting you, huh?
Well, I know the tone, well, was probably a little bit taunting, but it was also a plea. Don't give up the quest.
Well, this becomes kind of a confessional. And so it reminds me of Rousseau a little bit. You know, I don't know if you know Rousseau's confessional, but, you know, you're kind of laying it out there and saying, this is my younger self. This is who I am now. Trying to maybe even make the dancer and the dance come together.
Well, I'm picking up the mission I was on,
yeah,
which I had put aside for very good reasons, I thought, you know, having to do with political activism and strong commitment to social justice. But this was always in the background that I had to someday return and sort this out.
When did you particularly find yourself moving into that dimension of commitment to social justice, commitment to the kinds of things that you're more famous for now?
I picked a pretty standard case, a completely political blank slate. And then the war in Vietnam came along. My male fellow students were to talk about their fear of being drafted before they could complete their studies. Because in the beginning, there was no student exemption from the draft. And wham, it just hit me. Wait a minute, what's going on here? I haven't been paying much attention to the human world. I was a science student. I was completely involved in that. And I didn't know where Vietnam was exactly. I had no idea what possible reason there could be for taking young Americans and sending them there to kill or die. And just like that, it was a very quick epiphany.
Something very similar happened to me, but I always wonder now as I look back on that, and I have to ask you, if there would have been as much of a response to, let's say, the Iraq War, if there had been conscription, if young men were drafted as opposed to having a volunteer army. What are your thoughts?
I think the draft had a big effect.
Yeah.
Certainly did.
And then,
my generation.
Let's talk about science, because you have a PhD in immunology. A lot of your fans may not know that, but you've never been a practicing scientist, really.
No, I was. It doesn't really look good on paper, but I was fascinated by chemistry, started out majoring in chemistry, and then decided I wanted to get to the bottom of things and go into physics. So I kind of skipped into advanced physics courses. Foolishly, I think, way too advanced for my background.
Well, that made you feel perhaps you couldn't know all those things that you wanted to know?
But I knew if I had enough time
and
a little help, yeah, I could have. And then
You say you got to be crazy to understand quantum mechanics, either that or a genius. I mean, that's the old line.
Yeah, not that strange. And then migrated into biology, where I moved from molecular biology to finally cellular immunology and got my PhD. And then I said, I'm out of here.
But you've always been a rationalist, a scientific secularist, all of those kinds of things. And I suppose what this experience really revealed to you, especially when you looked at it in retrospect, was how much you can't know or cannot see that with a rational mind, what's invisible to us, just like microbes were invisible to us.
No, it does not convince me that there's so much we can't know. It convinces me that there's so much we ought to try to find out and understand. I am not satisfied with mystery, you know, with, this big hazy mystery out there and we should bow down before it, which was more or less what Goethe said, you know, that we should try to find out what we can, but then realize there's the unknowable and we should revere it, he said. No.
But there were things that were invisible to you as you look back at this and remain invisible to you. Now, I'm not saying that you shouldn't try to know those things, mm-hmm. but certainly what you're aware of now or cognizant of to a greater degree is that invisibility. Yeah.
Yeah, but there are ways around that. I mean, you just brought up the subject of microbes, which you do think you probably got from my book.
Yeah. Right. I thought about Isaac Singer once saying to me, we didn't know there was bacteria until we had microscopes, you know.
But, right. And if it was like 1820 and you were in the most august circles of European science, Western science, and you said, I think a lot of diseases are caused by little tiny creatures that we can't see, that are invisible. Anybody would have looked at you and said, you're nuts. We all know diseases are either caused by God's will or by kind of mists in the air. And, you know, turned out there were those little tiny animals. But it took, it took a lot of work to visualize them and show that they were responsible for disease.
I'm going to use a word that you may be a little resistant to. It's not spiritual, because I know you're very resistant to that word.
Thank you.
But I think it may have been one of my last interviews with the late Christopher Hitchens, and we were talking about the numinous, and he was reminding me that Ian McEwan and others had convinced him that there was something of the numinous, and you can't find a more hardcore atheist than Hitchens was. Is this something that you acknowledge or concede?
Yeah, I would use that word, numinous.
You're comfortable with that word?
Yeah. I don't know any one thing that Hitchens said about this, but Dawkins has been sort of a denier of the luminous, but he open to other people experiencing it. Another one of the new atheists, Sam Harris.
Yeah, they've all been on the show, actually.
But he writes about having what he calls spiritual experiences.
A lot of these are come through nature for people, or they come through their children, or they come through, doing something that makes them feel in the zone and exhilarated and transcendent even, yeah?
Well, I would say in general that extreme concentration plays a part, and possibly also changing the subject can cause them. When you go between topics very suddenly, you look up from that book you're so immersed in, and there's the world around you. You sort of have to sort it out. You have to put it together again there for a moment.
Talking to Barbara Ehrenreich, her new book is called Living with a Wild God, A Nonbeliever's Search for the Truth About Everything, and the emphasis, again, on everything. Where would these kinds of experiences fit into something like natural selection? Do they? Since you mentioned Dawkins,
no
I always
idea.
Think of Darwin when I think
I
of Dawkins.
I have no idea. Why there should be selection for such things. It's, here I'm just, I'm extrapolating, I'm speculating, but, a kind of person who in a small-scale society might be someone who had mystical experiences, certainly seems like it, would be a shaman. Mm-hmm. And shamans, play a part in social structure. That's important. There are also many cultures that feature rituals in which many individuals can be transported into a state that they will later identify as unity with one of their deities or spirits. And that, too, you could argue, has some kind of socially cohesive effect.
I wonder what you think about this story. You mentioned physics. Murray Gell-Mann, maybe major theoretical physicist. Anyway, he wrote a book about having experiences with a shaman, and he said he had a dream about a jaguar one night while he was being with this shaman. And the shaman asked him if he had a dream, and he said, yes, I did. I had a dream about a jaguar, and I don't know where that even came from. And the shaman said, I was the jaguar. I mean, I don't know what one does with those kinds of stories, but they keep cropping up. And here's a physicist, who, I don't know what his belief system was, but he was kind of wowed by that,
Yeah, I would be wowed by that, too.
Well, you were wowed by the experience you went through. I mean, it is an inexplicable experience. And it also, I think, you've gone through some changes, though. Become a little bit different in terms of your idealism, haven't you? I know you're still doing this hardship reporting project. You're still very committed as a social activist, but feeling like leftist politics didn't necessarily capture the American Republic the way you would have hoped for or wanted? Or am I reading too much into you here?
No, I think that there was a pulling back for me from certain notions of activism that involved meetings, 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 meetings. You know, that I began to just hate meetings. And I think that it was a big mistake on the left to try to build a culture around meetings. Meetings, that's a social form that originates, I think, in academia. I don't think it's that natural to us. But I have plenty to do that involves much less of meetings. I'm working on this. I've created something called the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, which tries to raise money to support starving journalists, of whom there is no shortage, to do cutting-edge journalism about poverty and economic hardship and inequality.
You've also become a lot more sensitive to animals and their feelings. We did a program recently with Jeff Mason, you know, who wrote When Elephants Weep and a number of other books that posit that animals have strong emotions, and I believe they do, and you now believe they do. That's made a big difference in your world vision, isn't it?
Well, maybe it should make more of a difference. I am, unfortunately, a member of a predatory carnivorous species, and I have not reformed in that respect. But the change since I was a graduate student, say, in the 60s in biology, is that we regarded animals, lab animals, as material, just like the reagents that came in jars, whether the mice and the rabbits and the other things. Nobody ever thought of them as having feelings. I was like the Dr. Mengele of the mouse world. I can't tell you how many I killed. Rather cruelly, too, but we'll leave that aside. And that's because there was nothing there. They were just little things, objects. Science has come around now to understanding what I think humans have always really known, is that they do have feelings. They are they have individual variations. They have even cultures in some cases. They're animals that make art. They're animals that are very altruistic, and even across species. So we've had our comeuppance. The idea that we humans are the only consciousness on Earth is rapidly being undercut.
Again, we're talking with Barbara Ehrenreich, and her new book is Living with a Wild God, getting back to the experience itself, getting back to the world coming up in flame and everything. It could have been, and I guess you're guessing still, aren't you? Some kind of dissociation, a psychedelic experience, something like Carl Gustav Jung experienced, or artist experience, or... but there was an episode with a guy. It was kind of a catalyst from what I read, you know?
A guy.
Yeah.
Not in a very direct way.
Right, but somewhat of a catalyst.
Are you talking about the guy on the skiing trip?
Yes.
Okay. The cataclysmic mystical experience that they all culminated in occurred in the context of a very poorly planned skiing trip I went on with a high school friend and my brother, my little brother. Up to Mammoth Mountain, which many people here will know about as a skiing area.
Hold that thought, because we're going up to a break here. I want to hear this narrative, mm-hmm. and I know listeners do too. And I'd like to hear from you, our listeners, especially if you think you've had a mystical experience. Barbara and I were at Book Passage last night in Marin, and somebody asked the question, how many have had a mystical experience? Now, this is in Marin, mind you, but about half the hands went up. So, if you have questions or comments for Barbara Ehrenreich, join us. Our toll-free number is available to you right now. It's 866-733-6786. We do welcome your calls. So join the program and the conversation at 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. I'm Michael Crest. This is Forum. Our guest this hour is Barbara Ehrenreich. Her new book is Living with a Wild God. And it's subtitled, A Nonbeliever's Search for the Truth About Everything. And it's a nonbeliever's struggle to make sense of a mystical experience, or mystical experiences really, that occurred to her as a teenager. And she was trained as a scientist and is a longtime atheist, but has been grappling to understand this experience that she had as a teenager. The book that came out of that, again, is Living with a Wild God. We certainly welcome your calls, and I just want to mention that Barbara Ehrenreich will be speaking tonight through Berkeley Arts and Lectures at the First Congregational Church of Berkeley, then at Bookshop Santa Cruz tomorrow, and at Kepler's in Menlo Park on Friday, and all those events are at 7:30 p.m. And we're going to go to your calls and emails. I actually threw out the question if any of you would like to join in about mystical experience you may have, or you may just simply want to talk to Barbara Ehrenreich and have questions and comments for her. And we welcome your involvement. You can go to our Facebook page. You can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at KQED Forum, or you can email us, forum@kqed.org. Before we went to the break, though, I want to finish this narrative. You were talking about the skiing experience.
Right. Okay. This is the context for the big mystical experience that occurred when I was 17.
The situation, as you called it. Yes.
Well, that's what I lived in every day, the situation. But we had gone skiing, a high school friend of mine, a boy, and who was not a boyfriend. I didn't really know him very well. And my brother, who was younger. We ended up kind of crazily, it seemed to me, not returning to L.A. from the Mammoth area right away, but spending the night in Lone Pine, California, in the car on the side of the road in town, such as it was a town at the time. I didn't really know why we were doing this. In my mind, for many years, I thought we must have had some car trouble or something. So long story short, I was exhausted.
Hungry, sleepy.
Hungry, yeah. Sleepy, hypoglycemia. Yeah. All the conditions I now realize that would be good for a Plains Indian on a vision quest. Because, you know.
They take people out to the desert even now to do sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. I guess they do stuff like this for fun, though I wouldn't. So I walked out of the car, and it was on that, you know, while walking through this town and about dawn, that suddenly the world flamed into life, and I experienced this combination of ecstasy and terror, because this is not just a nice, soft, fuzzy feeling.
No, scary.
Not at all.
Scary, yeah. But also ecstatic.
It's sort of a dialectical relationship. Yeah, the whole thing, after it happened, for the months after it happened, one, I was shattered and a little crazy, and two, I wanted it back.
Do you ever go back to Lone Pine?
No, I've got to do that. I hear it's really beautiful.
Be interesting to see how or what kind of effect it has on you after all these years. Let me go to our callers here and begin, Donna, with you. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call, and I'm very excited to talk to Ms. Ehrenreich. I've just finished reading her book. I had similar experiences as a teenager, and one in my early 30s, maybe late 20s. And the question I have, because the most recent experience I had, I experienced as a oneness with everything around me, the universe. And I've wondered if any of the events you experienced felt that way to you, as a oneness rather than an encounter with something outside of yourself.
I would say encounter works better for me to describe my experience. I know those feelings of oneness and unity, and they can be inspired by a beautiful sunset or all kinds of things. But this was a little bit more violent.
We mentioned Christopher Hitchens before. He actually told me a joke about the guy who's a hot dog vendor, and someone goes up, the Dalai Lama actually goes up and says, "I want you to make me one with everything." Hitchens loved that joke. All right. Thank you for the call, Donna. Let me go to another caller here, and that's Kay in Oakland. Kay, welcome. You're on.
Hi. I was in North Fremont at Coyote Hills Regional Park. I'd just driven up into the parking lot and got out, and I noticed a fox sitting right in front of me. And as soon as I got out of the car, she put a thought into my mind, which was, "Are you always so late?" And people that know me know that I am habitually late. And so I just kind of looked at her and indicated yes. And we started walking, and she was on my left side. And when people would approach, she would disappear. She would basically make a circle, run around, and then come back to my left side again. And she spent the whole time with me that I was walking in that park.
You're going to tell us you're a punctual person, not to a fault or anything?
No, I'm still regularly late.
That's a lovely story. I'm trying to imagine it.
So am I. It's well told. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Kay. Glad you joined us, and we'll be joined now by Christopher. Welcome. You're on.
Yeah, my question is, it was triggered from the brief discussion around natural selection, or the question around natural selection. And I just wonder how, if the author has opinions on how mystical experiences and religious experiences relate to power dynamics in societies and groups. And I think you probably can see where I'm going.
No, I can't see where you're going for sure, Christopher. One thing comes to mind, and I mentioned this briefly in my book, is that some claims of mystical experience may be spurious, because there have been religious systems on Earth where you got more credibility, you got status, if you could successfully claim religious, you know, such experiences. For example, Paul, in I think his letters to the Corinthians somewhere, says that
this is on the way to Damascus. Yes.
No. This is well after that. Huh? But he, that was his big claim to fame, right? The moment
vision
revelation,
yeah.
The vision on the way to Damascus, but. He took great pride in the amount at which he could, the frequency in which he spoke in tongues later, which was supposed to be a mark of a mystical experience. And I think that makes me a little bit, you know, suspicious. Like, you know, I do it more than you.
Let me thank the caller, and we'll move along here and get more of your calls on. Elizabeth, join us.
Hello?
Yes, hi. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm delighted to talk with you, as I'm a great fan. But my question is to both you, Barbara Ehrenreich, and Michael. And I'm wondering about the relationship between these kinds of spiritual experiences and dissociation.
Oh, I definitely think there is a relationship, Elizabeth. The build-up to my, quote, mystical experience was a series of dissociative experiences that began when I was about 13. And I didn't know that word, dissociative. I had no idea what was going on. It's just that I could occasionally, sometimes, out of my control when, see the world in a new way without the intervening layer of words, associations, human meanings, and so forth. Is that what you mean? I mean, that's what I later came to.
No, I'm a psychologist, and dissociation is it's a survival tactic, and it's also kind of a skill. But I think that I'm more interested in what you guys think than what I think.
Well, since you put the question, I felt dissociated, but I told Barbara that I wish I'd had a mystical experience. I write about this in a book I published called Spiritual Envy. I know she hates the word spiritual, but, you know, it's just expressing envy for people who have mystical or transformative experiences, or for that matter, are certain in their faith and in their beliefs. I think you can be dissociative without necessarily experiencing something along the lines that we're talking about.
Right. I'm saying I had these earlier dissociative experiences starting when I was 13. And I think they may have readied me in some way for the big thing that happened when I was 17. Because as you know, ordinary reality crumbled away, I wasn't frightened. You know, I was just not afraid to go into that place. I didn't say, what's happening to me? I better find an ER or something.
Thank you for that question, Elizabeth. Good to hear from you. And we will hear from some more listeners. We'll go to Sacramento. Francis, join us.
Yes, my name is Francis Liu. I'm Luke and Grace Kim, professor in cultural psychiatry emeritus at UC Davis. And I just wanted to apprise the listeners to a diagnostic category in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, 4th edition, and also in the 5th edition that just came out a year ago, entitled Religious or Spiritual Problem, which is not a mental disorder, but rather in the V code section called Other Conditions That May Be a Focus of Clinical Attention, of distressing experiences, such as I think what was experienced by the author here, that are involving things like this that could bring someone to a clinician. And the purpose of this diagnostic category is to provide a differential diagnosis of mental disorder versus distressing experiences that's very important in that differential. And I and Robert Turner and David Lukoff were the persons that proposed this diagnostic category that made it into the DSM-4 in 1994 and continues in the DSM-5.
We got a response from Barb Ehrenreich. Thank you for that.
Well, so you're saying you can distinguish between a mental illness and
yes.
Well, that seems
yes.
That seems odd to me. I mean, yes.
Well, it's meant to help clinicians with the differential diagnosis, so that something as you experience that was both a sense of oneness and also distressing could a clinician hopefully would make that differential and not.
Well, okay,
call it a
I think
disorder.
that's a good thing to do. I think when I was a teenager, if for any reason I had sought or been brought in to get clinical help, it would have been a pretty straightforward pathologizing of the experience.
So fortunate.
So it sounds like progress to say it's not always.
Thank you for the call. With this book, you were kind of surprised. At one point you were interviewed by a fellow atheist and he kind of held your feet to the fire and was actually hostile to you. I mean,
in the book I described it.
Yeah.
Oh, no. I was being interviewed on, it was one of those endless C-SPAN author interviews. And the interviewer brought up and said, are you an atheist? Because that was, I guess, well, it wasn't that long ago, but that, you know, it's like, are you?
Well, we're not any longer in the village atheist phase.
Right. I know. And I think I hesitated a nanosecond in answering, and my aunt, Marcia, picked up on that, and boy, was she after me. What's the matter? You know, are you or are you not a true atheist? I was just thinking.
Well, you mentioned Harris, Dawkins, we mentioned Hitchens. Just wonder about something along those lines. One of the things that prompted me to write the book I did was also a feeling that as much as I respected them and had affection for all of them, I really thought they were much too contemptuous about religion and much too easy in their attitudes about skewing it. And I kind of try to make a case, such as it was, for agnosticism, which may be a coward's way out, but nevertheless seemed to me to be a reasonable approach. And I found that there was atheist contempt, in some instances, more for agnosticism than there is even for religion.
Well, you know, my one of my issues with the new atheists is their notion of religion. They are going after a particular form of religion, which is the monotheistic religion. I mean, it's, you know, they're right to go after the big guys now, monotheistic. And it centers on a benevolent deity who has our interests at heart and is good. Now, that's easy to take down. That is so easy to take down.
Maybe too easy to take down.
Let me
just, in fact, one of the things that I was struck by in sort of formulating my own thoughts was the fact that as someone I know who cares about social issues as much as you do, there were many instances that I found going back to when I was working with prisoners that seemed to be the one thing that would sort of cure recidivism in some instances was finding faith and actually, you know, believing in higher powers and all that sort of thing. Gets people off of addiction. I mean, it does have some very good forces behind it, despite all the evil that people do in the name of religion.
Oh, I won't argue with that. I think it would be a wonderful thing if there were a benevolent deity who is going to punish the wicked and reward the good, and who's going to make sure that every disaster and tragedy, every asteroid strike and tsunami had some purpose. I cannot believe that, though.
Well, despite not being able to believe that, does it mean that you feel some contempt toward those who do?
No, I don't. I just don't ask me to share your belief.
Or try to force it on you.
Whatever, yeah.
Yeah. Let me read a listener, Mac writes, I was on a trip in Alaska last summer, sitting by myself on the closest deck of the boat to the water. I watched the sunset for hours between the islands on the horizon. In the distance, I could see dorsal fins of orca rising and falling, rising and falling. As I sat there, I heard a splash, felt a mist, and in front of me, not 10 feet, two orca were playing. One came out of the water, looked at me for a few seconds, it felt like eternity, and left never to be seen again. This was easily the most powerful moment in my life. Chance and beauty meeting at a perfect point for me to appreciate it. I think people who invest their faith in the divine to heavily miss the beauty and natural wonder and mysticism that surrounds us. If you're constantly looking for what you think exists, you miss the beauty that does.
Well, wow.
Well said.
I love that.
Yeah. So
I am jealous. Talk about spiritual envy. I have had experiences with dolphins, which don't come quite close to what you just read to us. But the understanding that there are other intelligences out there, other conscious beings, who want to interact with us, that's pretty amazing.
Dolphins actually have more convolutions on their brain than we do, and there is a correlation between convolutions on the brain and gray matter.
We're not the smartest species, I'm sure.
Here's Thusi, who writes, I love that Barbara Ehrenreich seems to extend her Socratic and open inquiry approach to everything she experiences and that she has always demonstrated such compassion in her investigations. She's kind of my ultimate wish fulfillment of a feminist and an American. So glad she's on forum. Thanks. We'll go to
Wow. Thank you.
Another caller, Neil, join us.
Yes, as an atheist, I'd like to know, Barbara, how you account for the fact that the two most militantly and aggressively atheistic societies in history were also the two most violently repressive, Stalinist Russia and Communist China. Isn't atheism supposed to be a positive force?
I wouldn't make a claim for atheism as a positive, progressive force by itself. No, I mean, you could look at very repressive religious societies, too. I don't think your case would hold with a worldwide survey of good and evil societies throughout history.
Yeah, I don't know if China and Russia should be at the top when one thinks of National Socialism in Germany.
Well, National Socialism, that's also kind of atheistic.
Yeah.
Hitler was pretty, he has no interest in religion. At all. And whereas we can think of, you know, on the other hand, we could think of various Catholic-dominated societies and the Inquisition and the destruction of so many cultures throughout the world by missionaries with armed forces, I should say, in the age of conquest and imperialism. So I don't think there's any clear-cut moral difference here.
Thank you, Neil, for the question. And on we go to another caller, and that's Adam. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Actually, I think I'm going to end up echoing a little bit of the sentiment here, but I personally consider myself a deist, which Benjamin Franklin was, this idea of God as the watchmaker, and he considered God basically just the origin of existence, and at that point sort of got less involved or not involved at all. And I feel like the problem with the notion of God is that we so often combine it with the idea of a sort of humanity or anthropomorphizing of God. And if you could remove that and just boil it down to just the reason that we exist rather than not, I find a lot of difficulty thinking my way out of the existence of God in that case. And it seems like deism is really the solution that I think a lot of people turn to atheism for and sort of miss it.
What about that idea? It wasn't only Ben Franklin. I think Jefferson was a deist that, you know, the watchmaker he created or some force created, whatever it was, he, she, it, and we've been on our own ever since.
Well, I mean, that's like, that's pretty close to atheism, I've always thought. You know, that idea of a God who then disappears. But I don't think we even think anymore scientifically that the world works like that, that it was a mechanism that was set going and then had to turn out certain ways because of the initial settings.
I don't think you necessarily need to have that idea of like of a preconceived notion. You could imagine God as simply chaos, which we see in so many other aspects of our lives, in the coding of DNA, for example, where if it wasn't for a little bit of chaos, we wouldn't be here to question it. And if you think of the universe as existing pre-Big Bang as a perfectly symmetrical structure, and then chaos being born into that, you get a Big Bang. And, like, there you go, science and God together.
Okay. Thank you for the call. We'll get another caller on. And Francis, that's you. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I have just two quick things. Number one, by saying mystical experience, you're prejudging the experience. I think a more accurate way to speak of it is a subjective experience which may or may not be explicable. That's the first thing. By saying mystical, you already imply you're prejudging what it is. Number two, the remark about agnostics being cowards, I think, is really a bit insulting. I'm an agnostic, and I think that is the toughest position to take, because the atheist who has this negative religion can feel quite comfortable in his atheism, but an agnostic is willing to keep his eyes and ears open for the entire duration of his life.
Well, I'm with you, and I actually wrote a whole book about that. But Studs Terkel was the one who said, he said, I'm an agnostic, and that's a cowardly atheist. And I've often thought about that. I also, and I thank you for the call, also I'm reminded of that great joke about the family of atheists moving into a neighborhood and someone burned a question mark on their lawn. You know, it's just sort of priceless.
I have a great discomfort with the phrase mystical experience. And that is something I came upon after years of study. I was looking for some connection to what other people had experienced, and I came upon that term.
It's a subjective experience,
yeah,
and I think that's what Francis suggested.
Right, but to say it's inexplicable, I don't agree with you on that, because my take on things, ridiculous as it may be, is, you know, I want to solve the inexplicable.
Well, here's what happens when you start throwing out jokes like that one I did about Hitchens, that Hitchens told. Gino writes, Dalai Lama story continued. The vendor hands the Dalai Lama his hot dog and says that'll be $4. Dalai Lama gives him a $20 bill and the vendor pockets it. The Dalai Lama says, where's my change? And the vendor says, true change comes from within. All right. Mark writes, very interesting conversation. I'm troubled that your guest is implying that mysticism and atheism are incompatible. Please have her address the following. We do not need to acknowledge a God, personal or otherwise, to appreciate the transcendent, ineffable, mystical, or awe-inspiring. Just take a quiet walk in the woods or on a stretch of beach.
Well, no, I am an atheist who has had mystical experiences. So I'm not guilty as charged. I think I've been somewhat misunderstood. In fact, I'm trying to take that realm of things out of the hands of religion so that we can all look at it.
Interesting question from a listener named Louise. Barbara Ehrenreich says she doesn't believe in God. I wonder if she could define the God she doesn't believe in.
It's the Big Daddy in the sky. God I do not believe in is the singular, and I won't even differentiate male or female, benevolent notion of God. That, I think, is a big mistake.
Who is involved in our everyday lives or in our human
affairs. Well, then it gets crazier and crazier. And when you have a God who is interested in your personal diet plan, no. You know, then I almost feel like religious. Like, that's an insult to God.
Here's Elizabeth who writes, I would never discount anyone's account of a mystical experience, but I'm wondering if these experiences are the result of a natural neurological alteration in brain function, such as happens artificially with psychoactive drugs.
Well, I think there is a materialist kind of description that we could finally arrive at of these sort of experiences in terms of neuronal activity and strange patterns of firing among the neurons in our brains? Yes, yeah, I hope so. I'm very interested in finding out what that is. I don't feel that it is related to psychoactive drugs because the descriptions I have read of those drugs, it's that they seem to create hallucinations. I did not have hallucinations. I saw no visions, no voices, heard no voices, nothing like that.
Have you thought of the symbolism? I mean, I'm talking maybe literature 101 here. That is, you know, often as we have fire, we associate fire with passion, obviously. We associate it with a destructive force, but also a cleansing and purgative force. It has great symbolic meaning.
Symbolic meaning? Well, no.
Literal and symbolic. No, I mean, fire is associated with you know, so many elemental things in life.
Well, yes, it's not a material object. It's a process. It's something that was very, very key to human evolution. The fact that our species, apparently uniquely, figured out how to capture fire and use it.
Do you still use any Zoroastrianism? You know, they were the so-called fire worshippers.
Yeah, no, that's fine. That's great. I'm not an atheist when it comes to fire.
No, you believe in fire.
Yeah, I believe in fire.
And air and water and earth and all the rest of the elements. Yeah. Well, we've got Barb Ehrenreich down on that. Always good to have you here. Thank you so much.
Well, this was fun.
Yeah, always fun to talk to you. And good luck with this new book, Living with a Wild God, A Nonbeliever's Search for the Truth About Everything by Barb Ehrenreich, who is also the author of Nickel and Dimed, and who will be speaking tonight through Berkeley Arts and Lectures at the First Congregational Church in Berkeley. That's at 7:30, and at the Bookshop of Santa Cruz tomorrow, and at Kepler's of Menlo Park on Friday. All those events, again, are at 7:30. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. We remind you, you can continue this discussion online by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also email us if you have suggestions of programming or comments on any programming we've done or you would like us to do, kqed.org/forum. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Gucci, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai with online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our interns are Jack Detch, Marisa Endicott, Mariam Jamil, Hannah Rose Levy, and Audrey Gertz. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.